Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
All right. Welcome. Thank you for coming today. This is the second installment in what we're calling a Distinguished Speaker Series. And I understand that we also have some folks that are looking in via video, so welcome to you all as well. We are going to take about 45 minutes today to have a discussion with our invited guest, Mr. Bob Wilson, who I'm happy to call a friend. And the idea of this speaker series is to take advantage of our location in Key West and to ask some folks who live here to talk to you all, to share their experiences so that you can hopefully benefit from hearing about older folks who have had some success in their lives, and maybe you can benefit from them. One of the things that I think about as I get older is when I was in high school, I did not pay enough attention to older folks who had a lot of lessons that I could have benefited from, and I sure could have avoided a lot of mistakes that I made if I had paid closer attention to. My name's Mike Downer, and my wife, Jessica, graduated from Key West High School. However, I think if Somerset had been around when she had gone to high school in Key West, she would have attended Somerset. We're big supporters of your school, and we think it's really important that parents and children have choice in education, because I think it makes a big difference. I was a lawyer and executive in a big company and for almost 40 years. And when I retired, my wife is from Key West, and so we moved back here, and we're really happy to be lucky enough to live in Key West as a retirement hobby, sort of. I own a wine shop that's catty corner from where we're sitting here, and we're very happy to be part of the Key West community. Bob Wilson, to my left, has a house that is, what, a block and a half from here, maybe? And so he's here to share some thoughts with you. And let me just give you some of his background, and we could probably spend the whole time allotted just giving you some of his background, but I'm going to briefly just give you a sketch before we get into our discussion. Bob spent nearly 40 years with a company called Johnson & Johnson, and in your daily life, you have come across products made by this company. It is a massive, massive company. It employs over 100,000 people across the world. It's interesting. This year, Fortune magazine voted Johnson & Johnson the number one most admired company on the pharmaceutical industry list. It's ranked number 37 out of the 500 largest companies in the world. Johnson & Johnson operates in 60 countries and has it has operations in 60 countries, but its products are sold in 175 countries. It started in 1886, and let me just give you some of the products that it makes. You heard of Band-Aids? That's Johnson & Johnson. Benadryl, Bengay, Efferdent, Imodium, KY Jelly, Neutrogena, Pepcid, Rogaine, and on and on and on. So Bob worked a long time for this company and did lots of things, but for about 13 years, he and another person were essentially the senior executives for Johnson & Johnson. And Bob rose to vice chairman. He served on the executive committee, and we're going to talk a little bit about what someone who serves on the executive committee of a major company does, but suffice it to say, or the way I would summarize it, is the executive committee of a major company makes all the important decisions. And it is a mind-boggling responsibility to run a company of that magnitude. So let's get into it, and let's hear from Bob. So Bob, when you were growing up, did you think that you'd grow up to run a company of the magnitude of Johnson & Johnson?
No, I didn't. But I had aspirations, and I went to school and got educated and took classes, and that in fact, in retrospect, prepared me pretty well for the jobs I wound up doing. Let me, is it okay to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Am I free to talk? Sorry. Well, first, let me thank all of you for being here. I enjoy doing this. I've been executive in residence at several graduate school business schools around the country, and they have students just like you, except they're a little older and have more experience. I also wanted to introduce my better half, Michelle. Why don't you stand up? Yes. She's terrific, a great athlete also. Do you have sports? Yeah? Do you have a basketball team?
I think this is true, that by going to Somerset, you can participate in Key West High School athletics. Is that true?
And is that actively what you do? Yeah. So I played basketball and baseball in high school and in college. And that was good. So I was kind of competitive, and I also took every class I could get. And at that time, this is a long time ago. At that time, you had three choices in high school. When you were in the eighth or ninth grade, you could choose. And I chose college prep, what's called college prep then. I assume you have a similar thing now. And that's what I took. And I took, and sometimes those classes were at odd times, at 7:30 or at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I took physics, I remember, at 8 o'clock in the morning. And you got good math and science. And I always liked those courses. So as I progressed, then I'm from Kentucky originally. And went to school there. And Kentucky at that time was always known for basketball. So my brother's 6'8", I'm 6'5". So he played for Louisville basketball, and I played for Georgetown. We worked at it, went through school. When I got in college, we had some rooms that were large, and you'd have three or four people in a room. And since I was majoring in economics and minoring in finance, and I got all this grief from my roommates, who two of them were pre-med, about the dumb basketball players. So I wound up taking some of their, I wound up having a minor in pre-med the time I graduated. And I took anatomy and physiology, and I took chemistry, and I took, they had a class called clinical pharmacology in college. I took that. Anyway, I took these classes that were, I didn't know it at the time, but in retrospect, they were very beneficial. Six or seven years later, I graduated, and at that time the Vietnam War was going on, so I wound up in the Army, and for about three years, and when I got out of the Army, Johnson & Johnson I had talked to them before I got in the military. And then once I got out, they said, come back and see us when you get out. And they wanted me to go to work for them as a sales rep in Columbus, Ohio. So that's what I did. And I did that for about 2 years and then got promoted and went to Detroit. Was there for about a year as a trainer. I was training new employees and also had the major hospitals in Lansing and Ann Arbor and Detroit, and called on them, got to know the people in those that ran those hospitals. I then was promoted to a manager in Indianapolis. I made a tour of the Midwest on my in my early work, and was then was in the Midwest then for a couple years, and I had 12 sales reps that worked in Ohio and Indiana, Illinois, and one in Iowa, and so I did that for 2 years, and then I moved to New Jersey, and what was called the Eastern Regional Manager. And I had about 75 sales reps and 8 different managers that worked for me. Did that for 1 year and was made director of marketing for one of the Johnson & Johnson companies. And did that for 2 years and moved on to be the president of the dental part of Johnson & Johnson. And I was 36 and knew what happened with these classes. And let me give you a little insight for all of you about bigger companies. Often you'll get people in marketing or people in research or people in finance, but they're very focused on finance or on research or on marketing, but they don't have much knowledge in the other areas. And one of the great benefits I had is that I had taken, because of my roommates, I had taken these classes that were pre-med. And so I knew a lot about marketing and about sales and about finance. And when I wound up having a double minor, I had finance and I had pre-med. And a degree in, you know, my major was economics. So I left this out at this point. But then I was asked if I'd like to go to graduate school by Johnson & Johnson. And so I went to Columbia Business School which is in Manhattan. And so I did that for two semesters. And and actually part of that time was at a place called Arden House, which was about 40 miles north of New York City in the Catskill Mountains. And it was the old Harriman estate that was called Arden House. Now what's happened since then, now this was in the 70s. Columbia University sold that. They owned it, and they sold that Arden House facility, and it's now an environmental center, and they have about 40,000 acres there, and it's all protected land. It's still a beautiful place. But anyway, I really enjoyed that. And the reason I kind of left this out along the way too, but the reason I'm here is because I love to fly fish. And so I've been coming down to the Keys since 1966. And I love to fish for tarpon and bonefish. And I came with my dad in 1966. And so we've been coming down since then, and then wound up, you know, with a house here, and go back and forth. We still have a house and a couple of farms on the East Coast in New Jersey and in Pennsylvania. But the most interesting part of it was when I got to J&J, there were people that really had great knowledge and great knowledge in marketing, great knowledge in research. But they were a little afraid when they started, when they got out of their zone of knowledge. And so I always felt like I had an advantage going through these jobs because I wasn't afraid to ask questions about science or about, and when you get into a place like J&J, the biotech, I kind of started the biotech movement within J&J, and we did all sorts of interesting things at that time. This was in the late 70s, early 80s. We wound up sending an electrophoresis unit, which is separation of large molecules, on the space shuttle because we couldn't make enough of the material with the gravity on the ground. You have to separate these large molecules, and we wound up with a drug, erythropoietin, which was a great step forward in treatment of anemia, which that drug came out in 1985. So there were all these steps along the way I felt more confident going into some of these questionable areas just because I had knowledge of marketing. I had knowledge of pretty good knowledge of finance. I wound up being on the board of some other large companies, and I wound up being the chairman of the audit committee on a couple of them. And then also because of my science background, there was a man that I met a few times, and I loved the guy, and he was brilliant. He was from the UK. His name was Sir James Black. And he wound up winning the Nobel Prize in medicine. He asked me to go with him to Stockholm to get it. And I still remember all that.
Wow.
Sure.
Let me ask you this, Bob. And by the way, if you have any questions, because we're throwing out terms like finance and audit committee, and you may not know what that means. So if you have any questions, just feel free to raise your hand. As you look back, like you've served on a bunch of different boards, you obviously had a long career with Johnson & Johnson. You had a lot of experiences doing lots of things. As you look back, what do you know now that when you were starting out and put yourself in the shoes of the kids sitting here that you wish you knew then that you know now? Is there anything that, all this experience that you have, you wish you knew when you were starting out that you know now? Like, I always think about that.
Yeah, well, I actually, I have children of my own, and they're now older and have done well. And I tried to talk to them about it. But one of the things that when you're young, you don't have the knowledge and about what taking a physics class at 8 o'clock in the morning means when you're 16 and what it can mean to you or taking a class later in college in clinical pharmacology or anatomy and physiology and because there's no direct relationship with what I wanted to do. I wanted to be in business, and I wanted to be in a big company or start my own company or be successful in my chosen field. So you don't know, but it is important to take advantage of opportunities in fields that you might not have a lot of knowledge in. But they can be helpful. It can be helpful later. My daughter's a psychologist in Northern California and has a private practice. And my son is an engineer, and he's with a company. It's now primarily owned by General Motors, and it's making driverless cars. And my son's been heading up that whole, the whole group on the driverless cars. They now have approval in San Francisco. They have 370 of these cars with no driver that go around. And if you get on your iPhone and call them up, the car shows up and you get in the back of the car and there's no driver. And the driver, the car takes you where you want to go. And they have approval. That's happening right now. And he, but he also loves to ski. And I talked to him last night. He's in Jackson, but his office is in San Francisco. And he's in a meeting today. This morning, he was flying to Phoenix for a meeting because the next city they're going into is Phoenix with their driverless cars. I encourage both of my kids to go on. And if there was some something offered, and it might not be directly related to their major, but it could be helpful to them in the future to go in and take it, you know, take the chance on taking this other class that might be useful. And I think just keeping an open mind and going on and taking these classes is important. I also think it's important to do the best you can and to be enthusiastic about it, to go on and help other people and do the best you can as you move through life.
Yeah, I mean, another thing that I've always thought about, I'd be interested in your perspective. Often, I think you learn more from things that you fail at than things that you're successful at. And I wonder if you could share with us something that you failed at that you learned from. Or did you ever have a failure?
Yeah, everybody has some failures, yes. Yeah, you do have failures. One of the great failures was I tore the cartilage in my knee when I was a sophomore, and so I didn't get to play that year, or my junior year, but did play then in my senior year. But that was a physical failure that, you know, I regret, and I wish I could have gone on and played more at the time. Yeah, and there are other things along the way, but I move ahead and I calculate that in the back of the brain there and say, gee, here's what I could have done a little better maybe, and or taken a different approach to have been more successful. But, you know, along the way, I mean, I did want to be on some other boards. And so J&J has one view of the world in the healthcare area, but there are other businesses, and I thought that would be interesting. One of them was Schwab. Charles Schwab is an investment company, and so I wound up being on the board of Schwab for about 20 years. I was on the board of a large gas and oil company for about 20 years, and
so you're on the board of these companies. For the benefit of the audience who may not know what someone on a board does, like when you're a member of a board of directors, what do you do?
Well, you overview the company, and you look at it, and the people, the development of people. There's usually a committee for finance. There's an audit committee that reviews the company's finances to make sure everything is on the up and up, and that you're there, the company is running the financial area in a way that is beneficial to the company, but also beneficial to the employees. And there's always research. There's a research, usually a research committee on the board, and there's a committee for people that, you know, the health and welfare of all the employees. So there are usually five committees on most boards, and each board member would be chair of one of those committees. And they work with the CEO or the chairman or the vice chairman or the president of the company to ensure that the company's on track, and that if there are big questions, big issues coming up, the long-term effects, long-term planning is important, and you play a role in all that. within the company. And you meet employees, and there's an annual shareholder meeting. Ours was always toward the end of April. We always had 1,000 to 2,000 people that would attend the company, and we'd be sitting on a stage like this, and you make a presentation about how you think the company's doing and what the problems are and what the opportunities are going forward. But you're also, you have a long Q&A session with the employees, with the shareholders. And these are the people that really vote on, and there's a proxy statement that goes out, a statement of how the company's doing for the year and for each quarter. And you get questions about all that from the audience. And you get tough questions. People sometimes are unhappy with something you've done in running the company, and they get up and talk about it. And sometimes if it's a hot issue, they'll get other people that stand up and support them, and you have to defend if you're part of that decision and what the company decided to do, you have to defend your position. So it's you have to be able to think on your feet a little bit and be able to answer the questions and in a way that respond to the audience. But anyway, I don't know. If I look back to your question, you go through life and you do have failures sometimes, but you don't want to dwell on them too much. You want to just regroup and move ahead and really all the time try to do the best you can. So,
yeah, I mean, I think the term that I've heard is it's good to have a memory like a goldfish when it comes to failures and just keep on moving ahead. So going back to your days at Johnson & Johnson, you had a lot of different positions. I know that at one point you were the head of the pharmaceutical division and you had responsibilities for a lot of different things. Can you share with the audience here some of the biggest challenges you faced when you were at Johnson & Johnson? And I'm sure with an organization that size, with so many different subsidiaries, so many different products, so many different countries you're operating in, I'm sure there were no shortage of challenges, but can you just share a couple of major issues that you were involved with, just to give us a flavor for the kinds of issues that you personally dealt with?
Sure. I guess the biggest challenge I had was that Johnson & Johnson was not in the pharmaceutical business when I started. And Johnson & Johnson's now, I think, the largest in the world. It's about $106 billion. And but we weren't in that business. And so when I got to a certain level in the company, I'd been promoted some times. And when I was in these field jobs, but then once I got back in the main office, there was a lot of resistance to getting into the pharmaceutical business. And and the chairman at the time was an older conservative guy, and he was against it. You know, he had all these reasons that he felt were good reasons, and he didn't want to do it. But I would make presentations to him, and finally, after a couple of years, it wasn't immediate, but after a few years, he agreed to go on and take this, what he considered to be a major risk. I considered it to be a great opportunity that was going to be flawlessly executed, and and it was. That's what we did. But I saw the opportunity there, and he just couldn't get it. And finally he did, and he let me do it. And we moved ahead. And right away it was very successful. But it is just being persistent, persevering on something you really believe in. And I was at the verge, if J&J wouldn't do it, I was thinking about maybe going somewhere else and trying, going with another company. But they did come around, and it turned out very successfully, and And that, you know, that was about, 40 years ago now. So they were not, and, you know, Merck was in the business of pharmaceuticals, and Bristol Myers Squibb and Eli Lilly, and those are all companies that were established and actively in business. J&J had products that were health related, but they weren't in the pharmaceutical business. So it was a big step, a different step. And I think some of the people were uncomfortable doing it, but they're very comfortable now. They're the leader in the whole field.
So, you know, it's interesting, Bob, and this is really something to think about for you guys. Like I always think, you know, what makes somebody successful, or you know, what attributes do you have as you go through life? And here's just something to think about. No matter what you do, and I think Bob just touched on it, no matter what position you have, it's going to involve some degree of salesmanship. And even if you think that you're doing something that doesn't involve sales, it does. And so I think the vignette you just touched on is really interesting, because here's Bob in a big corporation, and he's got an executive position, and he wants to do something new. And basically what he's doing is he's making a sale to get in a new line of business. And if he hadn't been a good salesperson, it wouldn't have happened. Now, you may not think that was a sales thing, but it really is. And so one of the things just to think about as you get into the world is, no matter what you do, if you can't, you know, communicate, and you can't express your vision, it's hard to get things accomplished. And so I think that's a really great story, because it's really the key, I think, to one of the keys to being successful, at least in my view.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. You're absolutely right. And I mean, of course, when I, J&J was a great company back when I went with them. There people are very comfortable with what they know, and a lot of the management didn't know much about this other field that I was interested in and wanted to move that way, and I thought we had what it took, and but they were reluctant to do it. But you know, you had to keep selling, as you're saying, but you have to be persistent, and you had to do it without alienating anybody. You didn't want to, you know, there were two or three guys that were running the company that didn't know much about pharmaceuticals, and you didn't want to alienate them, but you wanted them to be smart enough and understanding enough to be able to accept what the great opportunity was. So you're right.
And I guess the challenge for you all today, and this is, I think, even more pronounced than when we were younger, is if you look at the big businesses that exist today, they didn't exist when we were in school. I mean, you think about the biggest businesses out there, Google. Google didn't even exist when I was in college. When I was in college and when Bob was in college, there weren't personal computers. There weren't, This didn't exist. This whole business didn't exist. So it's really amazing that when you're our age, probably the biggest businesses, nobody's even thought of. And that's the real challenge, is to somehow put yourself in a position, right, to be able to go into the businesses and be able to thrive, even though you don't know what they are. And I don't know how you do that.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, Apple, Microsoft, Google, they're terrific businesses today that didn't exist at all when I was, you know, actively moving up in the ranks at J&J. IBM existed then, and we dealt with IBM quite a lot. In fact, I'm still on a conference call with the guy that used to be chairman of IBM tomorrow.
but here's an interesting factoid about IBM. When IBM started, they thought they would not sell more than 20 computers. I mean, the computers they made were so large. So it turned out that their business developed in ways that they could never anticipate. So the world is really interesting. And I think that today more than ever, you have to be in a position to just be super flexible, because the world just evolves in ways that you just can't predict.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Let me go off track a little bit.
Yeah.
Is that all right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. How many of you play sports? Raise your hand if you play. Do you play any sports? This group over here is a little quiet. You fish. There you go. Well, that counts. But that's good. What do you guys do over here? What is it? Wrestling? Good. What about the guys back here? Yeah. Wrestling too? Yeah. Yeah. Is basketball a big sport here? Does anybody play basketball anymore? Yes. Good. All right. That's great. What about baseball?
Baseball's big.
Baseball's big? Anybody here play baseball?
That counts. Has anyone had a chance to play on the new baseball field? Yeah. Pretty nice, huh? I just redid the baseball field. It's on Roosevelt.
Out by the school?
Yeah,
good. Good. I just want to put a plug in that I think it's helpful as you move on up through the education system. If you can play a sport and excel at it a little bit, that's a big advantage too as you go through life. That really helps. So if you get a chance to do it, go on and do it.
So let me just pause here, because we just have about 15 minutes left, and ask if there are any questions of Bob. I see a hand right there. And let me do this. Let me go down with the microphone so you can talk into it and we can hear you.
My question is, what's the biggest tarpon you've ever caught?
Great question.
143 pounds on a fly rod.
Bob, you talked a lot about being well-rounded as one of the secrets as you were, well, one of the advantages as you were coming up through J&J, but how do you stand out? Like how does a young person today stand out in a sea of everybody smart? Or is it looks? Is it personality? What was it that allowed you to rise so meteorically through there? You talked about, you know, a year here, a year there.
Well, I hesitate to tell you. But my height helped a lot. And I'm sorry, but it did. And, you know, if you're, you know, fairly tall, people tend to remember you better. So it did help. But I also think you have to be able to be affable and be able to communicate well. I mean, if I was a tall guy that was awkward or didn't really get it, it wouldn't have worked. But if you got to know people and people remembered you because of your height, it always helped to be able to converse in a way that left the impression that you were intelligent and you were interested in fly fishing or interested in baseball or interested in science. You know, that all that helps together. You kind of give it's a combination of things, but it really does help.
There's a question in the back. I'm going to take the microphone there. Yes, sir.
What would you say is the biggest dream killer?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
Dream killer.
Oh, dream killer. Well, I think probably in all companies, or not just in companies, but could be in public policy too. People are often reluctant to take the risk. I mean, what I described to Johnson & Johnson was these people knew they had a they had a great business with Band-Aids and a line of products, but they didn't know a lot about pharmaceutical products, and they knew that it was expensive to get in. The research cost is high to get in, so the door to open would be expensive. So they were reluctant to try something new when they had a great business that was operating well. I think if you can make your case, usually it's selling the people on, even if it's a new company. I mean, I'm chairman of a company right now in La Jolla in Southern California. It's a biotech company, and we're going public March 17th. We've been working on this for a couple of years, and everybody here has a pancreas. Pancreas, you know what a pancreas is? You do. You know what it is? Yes? Do you really know what it is? I'm sorry? I couldn't hear you. I'm sorry. Well, sort of. Mike, give your microphone to Dr. Winant.
Can you explain
it? It's an organ that produces insulin to control blood sugar in your body. It controls blood sugar in your bodies. It's an organ. If your pancreas doesn't work, you could have insulin-dependent diabetes. And if you eat too much sugar and carbs, you can get type 2 diabetes. So be very careful.
Okay, that's good. Right now, there's been a big increase in pancreatic cancer in this country. Well, not all over the world. And there's no treatment for it. People try things, but there's nothing good. Anyway, we're working on this this pancreatic acute pancreatitis. Is usually the forerunner of pancreatic cancer. And so we're working in that area on a drug that's new and different. And it looks like we'll get approval maybe in a year, year and a half. But the company itself needs financing. And so we meet with people and we talk to them about the company and we talk to them about the interest we have in the pancreas, and we have good data already at some hospitals around the country, and we have a special study at the hospital in Memphis, the Children's Hospital, St. Jude, on children that are born with a faulty pancreas, and our drug, if you give it to them within 2 weeks of birth, these kids die right now. These babies die. But we're titrating the dose, the human dose, to the baby's weight, and none of the kids have died. It's a big difference. And so I think the opportunity is to go on and talk to people about what you have that can change the health and welfare of the population. And that's what you try to do, whether the target is the pancreas or it's some other organ. But there are things out there just waiting to be improved. And it takes some effort on the part of all of us, all of you all going forward to improve it. Mike.
So you've done a plethora of things, obviously, in your life. So this question comes from one of the virtual students. Her name is Emma. She's in Italy. And she asks, what are you most proud of in your professional life?
I didn't. What? Emma's a what?
She's a virtual student with Academica International, and she's out of Italy. So she's asking, what are you most proud of in your professional life?
I think I'm most proud of the progress we've made with the drugs we've developed, Sir James Black, the man I mentioned, was the man that came up with beta blockers for heart, beta blockers. I don't know. Is Jessica back there?
Hold on. All right. So beta blockers are a drug that affect your heart rate. Some people have high heart rates called tachycardia. And so the beta blockers slow the heart rate down to help control blood pressure and heart rate. Any questions?
Jessica. Thanks. I didn't know that was you. It's the light from the light. I can't see right there. There's a blind spot. There's a question.
Two more questions.
Okay.
I'll get to you after this.
You'll be next right here.
So, what's the thing you would really stress for someone getting ready to go into college? Like, what's the most important thing you would say?
Sorry, I couldn't hear the first part of that. Sorry.
He would like to know, what would you stress is the most important thing to think about for someone just about to enter college?
Well, the choice of college is important. You know, where you decide, where you can go, where you can afford to go, what kind of a deal you can make with the college. You know, to make sure that it's what you want to get out of it 4 or 5 years later. So that's, to me, that's a really key step. But I think if you choose, and it's not usually just one, there are probably several that could fit the bill for each one of you. But it is important step, and it's important. So good. The thought process to go through in a college is also good for you. You know, the process of going through that, deciding where you think, what you think your interests are, what you think you want to do with a career, and where you think that could be delivered well for you. Here in front.
Hi, I have a question. When did you stop being like the thing for Johnson & Johnson and Ed Sheeran? Yeah, that thing. I'm not very good at.
No, go on. Can you repeat the question?
Like when did you stop like working for Johnson?
She's asking when you retired from Johnson & Johnson. Is that your question? Early 2000s, correct?
2003. Yeah, after the annual meeting, and I retired in May of 2003 because we want to get through the annual meeting and then retire, and then the new crew takes over. Let me talk about that too, because it's something that I didn't expect that happened. I was going to go on a few boards and go fishing more and, you know, be retired. And I was 63 at that point. And but then I was offered all these jobs. So I became chairman of a hedge fund in New York. And did that, and as a result of that, we had an umbrella of funds. We started a hedge fund. We had $2 or $3 billion that we raised for the hedge fund, and then we had a venture fund. If you're starting a new company like this company that I'm chairman of now in California, we started a series of companies, and I was chairman of most of those companies, and we just sold the last one about 4 years ago to a Chinese company. And then we started one other group of companies that also were investment companies. Anyway, I did that until 2010 or 11. But then I stayed as the chairman of the companies we had started, And then the last of those was sold, as I said, about 3 years ago. One of the others that...
And Bob, just a hedge fund is just another name for a company that raises money and they take it and they invest it on behalf of investors.
Yeah, it's an investment company. So those, to complete it, to bring you up to date, totally. So I was here in Key West and COVID had arrived. And there was a guy named Paul Volcker who was chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of the United States. He was a good friend. He loved to fly fish. So I went fishing with him a lot, different places around the world. And he died in December of 2019. And so I was down here with Michelle, and we were and with the Winans, our friends. And then somebody called me and said, in fact, the two people that called me were people that I had hired to run the venture fund back in 2003, after I had retired from J&J and got involved in these other companies. And they had, we started a venture fund with them, and they were the highest rated venture fund for the year that they the what they call the vintage year in the investment business. And these funds are usually last 10 years. You put money in it, you put $100 in, $100,000 in, whatever, and you invest it, and then you get return on that over those 10 years. They ran the most successful venture fund for those 10 years. And but then they left and started a different fund. They called me and said, we have the science and we'd like you to look at it and decide if you would be chairman of the company for us. So that's how I wound up being chairman of the company that we're now going public, and in March we'll be a public company. I'm getting a signal from the rear for a question. Yes.
Do you think being in the military helped you at all for your future?
I do.
Like, in what ways?
Well, because of my knee that I explained, I tore the cartilage when I was a sophomore. I was told that I wouldn't qualify to be in the Army. So I thought I wouldn't be going in the Army. But then, you know, the world situation changed, and all of a sudden I went and took a physical, and they said, oh, you're in great shape. You ought to go in the Army. So you can come right in here. So I went into the Army, and at the time, there was this, in my own personal self, I didn't expect that. So I went into the Army, and the second day I'm going to get my hair cut, and I'm standing there, and I'm in great shape. You know, I could run. And I this big drill sergeant comes up to me and he says, hey boy, you ever play basketball? I said, yes, drill sergeant. And he said, you play in high school? Yes, drill sergeant. Play in college? Yes, drill sergeant. Want to see you at the gym tomorrow at 3. This is the second day I'd been this was at Fort Jackson in South Carolina. And so I said, I don't know where the gym is. I just got here. And he said, ask your sergeant. He'll tell you how to get there. He'll get you there, in fact. I said, okay, thank you. So the next day I go to the gym, and there must have been 100 guys there, and they were all trying out for the basketball team, for the base, for the Fort Jackson basketball team. So right away I scoped it out, and a lot of them played in high school, but I don't think maybe one or two played in college, but maybe not many. But anyway, so I'm on the, by the third day I was there, I'm on the base basketball team. And I played basketball. I like to fish, but I also like to hunt. So I knew how to take care of guns, and I was very safe with guns. And They knew that, and we went to the rifle range, and I could shoot well, and and I could run, you know, in basic training, you're just running all the time. But I was in really good shape, so I could run with any of them and beat most of them. And so the basic training took about 7 or 8 weeks. But during the time I was in basic training, the first game then, we played another team from the base. And I mean, I didn't know all this happened in the Army, but they had our whole brigade march over with drums, you know, they had to march to the game to watch me play. It was fantastic. So I hit 28 and we won the game, and I'm standing there on the floor just the game is over, and this colonel comes up and he says, "Wilson, you played a great game." I said, thank you, sir. Do you need to ride back your barracks? I said, "Well, I guess I do, but my group might get a little mad at me to get a ride back, because they're going to have to, because the barracks was about 5 miles, and they would double time back to the barracks after the games." Anyway, so he said, "I got my Jeep here. Let me give you a ride." So I went out and I got in the Jeep and I rode back, and anyway, so we had other games, and he said, "Wilson, you need to be at practice at 3 every day. So, you know, I want to make sure that at lunch, you go on and have lunch with your unit and then go on and head for the gym." So I was kind of on half, you know, half duty. I was playing basketball and kind of enjoying life. And that was the Army. So I think the Army did help me, because I got over all this.
So you were saying the Army was very, very good to you.
I think the Army was fine with me, yeah. It got more complicated. There's another place called Fort Benning. I wound up at Fort Benning, and then I wound up in the 325th Infantry. This was pretty emotional, because it was the 82nd Airborne. And it was tough training, much tougher than basic training. And I wound up then at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. And I played basketball some there, but it was I was the armorer, because I was a little older than most of them. And this is infantry, so we had, at that time, we had mortars, and we had recoilless rifles, and we had rocket propelled grenades, and we had M16s, some M14s, but everything was kind of cycling into new technology. I had responsibility for all the weapons in this headquarters unit. And it's a responsible job to take care of all these weapons. And you know, guys, there are a lot of younger guys that didn't know much about guns. Now, at that time, they knew more, but they were still reckless sometimes. So you really had to watch over them, and that was a responsible job. And I think, they kept wanting me to go into officer training. I didn't want to do that. So I wanted out when I was supposed to get out. So I was in about 3 years in total, and then out, and, you know, moved on with J&J.
So, as I understand it, the bus is about to leave. So I want to, on behalf of Tom and the school, I want to thank you, Bob, very much for sharing your experiences.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank all of you.
Thank you.